Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. It's hard to imagine a world where we leave future generations with fewer rights and freedoms. Since the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills aimed at blocking people from getting the essential sexual and reproductive care they need, including abortion. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves access to care. And with supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
I'm Jonquilin Hill. This is The Weeds. And antitrust is kind of having a moment. Last week, it was reported that soon, the Department of Justice will sue Live Nation.
The Wall Street Journal reports the suit will allege the nation's biggest concert promoter has leveraged its dominance in a way that undermined competition for ticketing live events.
Just for a quick refresher, Live Nation is Ticketmaster's parent company. They own venues that artists perform in, and they handle the ticket sales too. Now, I know I'm not alone when I say I have been burned by the ticket buying process. It happened with SZA, it happened with Usher, and it will probably continue to happen as the summer concerts roll out. It's that way by design. They've got so much control over the market that they've united the Beehive and Swifties alike. But this is about more than ending Stan Wars. Live Nation isn't the only company in the Biden administration's crosshairs. They've already taken legal action against other companies they say have monopolistic practices, including Apple, Google, and the behemoth known as Amazon.
My name is Dana Mattioli, and I am the author of The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power.
Dana didn't just write a book about Amazon. She covers Amazon for The Wall Street Journal, and it's a beat she requested. She used to cover mergers and acquisitions, or M&A as they call it in the biz, and something about the online retailer really stuck with her.
It started with the retailers being afraid of Amazon for obvious reasons, and they would do these defensive deals to try to bulk up or to defend themselves from the giant. But over the course of my time covering M&A, it wasn't just the retailers that became nervous. Other companies, other industries started living in fear of Amazon. And some of them would do mergers to try to insulate themselves. And it just started to become a conversation with all the bankers, all the lawyers I spoke to. It was becoming a major topic of concern in every boardroom across industries, from entertainment to healthcare, where companies started to wisen up that Amazon could enter their spaces. It was likely that they would. And if they did, they had a problem.
So when we think of Amazon, we think of it being this huge company. It's even been compared to Standard Oil, which famously was deemed an illegal monopoly by the Supreme Court in 1911. But Bezos's company wasn't always this big.
This was definitely not a company that was predestined to become the size that it is. Actually, when Jeff Bezos started this in 1994, it was more likely that it would have failed. He was starting a company predicated on people owning computers and using them to online shop back when most people didn't even have a computer. Mm. And the people that did were wary of typing their credit card into their computer and into the abyss when they could just as easily go to a bookstore or the mall to pick up what they needed. People liked physical shopping. So this was just like such a novel idea at the time. And I think we tend to forget that.
Yeah. How did we go from, you know, people being afraid to put their credit cards in? As I was reading the book, it's so funny. People would call and be like, can I just give you my info over the phone? I'm not comfortable, you know, typing it. How do we get from that to, you know, I'm sure most of our listeners could probably log onto the computer right now and like click something and get like, I don't know, sunscreen delivered today.
It's really fascinating because when Amazon was first starting, there was such a steep learning curve for shoppers. There's a scene in the book where one of Amazon's early employees pulls Jeff aside, and it's right after they launched the website in 1995, right? And they weren't sure who would show up for the reasons we just spoke about. But in a matter of weeks, people were ordering books from every state in the country. And it was really taking hold by word of mouth and other means. And the early employee, who was someone who joined the company because he was an idealist, he wanted to democratize reading, pulls Jeff aside and he says, you know, starting to get a little worried. What happens to independent bookstores like Elliott Bay, which is like a beloved bookstore in the Seattle area? And I don't even think Jeff initially believed in the type of success it would achieve, because he said to this worker, oh, no, nothing will ever happen to Elliott Bay. People love it too much, right? He thought there was room for both. But what we've seen is books were the canary in the coal mine. You know, it quickly became the place to online shop for books. You know, 82% of all ebooks are sold on Amazon. The preponderance of physical books are sold there too. And they didn't stop there. From there, they started expanding their tentacles first in retail, but then in other industries. And that's where it started to accumulate all this power. It's like kind of like that Standard Oil octopus that you see the cartoons of.
There are lots of jaw-dropping anecdotes in your book, and it highlights some really wild business practices. What are some that stick out to you the most?
So I was able to find a number of egregious business practices while investigating this company. One of them is, you know, Amazon touts itself as being customer-obsessed, but the company in the background has profited from selling dangerous items such as carbon monoxide alarms that don't detect carbon monoxide, fake tourniquets, which is really like a life or death situation if you need to use a tourniquet and it doesn't work, children's clothing that have strangulation hazards, and a lot of these... Uh-oh, it looks like we're being kicked out of this room. Hold on.
This has happened to us before. Don't worry about it.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'll find another spot, and then we could just resume. Okay, bear with me.
Even Wall Street Journal reporters get kicked out of conference rooms. Dana was a really great sport about it. And once she was resettled in a new room, we dove back into some of the stories in her book, including one that stayed with me long after I read it. It's about a company called Ubi.
So in 2012, this company called Ubi out of Canada was created by a bunch of dads who had full-time jobs and young babies, and they created what would be a first-to-market kind of device, which would listen to voice commands and then execute them. It could do things like play music or check the weather or send emails, and this is sort of a technological marvel at the time. What's interesting about Ubi is their founder, Lior Grebler, who I spoke to for the book, he thought it could be the next big hit. And he guessed Jeff Bezos' email. He tried a few different configurations and emailed him and said, you know, I'm working on what could be a Star Trek computer. He sort of appealed to Jeff Bezos' nerdy Star Trek side. Jeff sounded super excited, and he connected him with someone at Amazon for a meeting. And this person flew out to meet with Lior and his team, and they started talking about deal talks. And what was interesting is the person that Jeff connected him with sort of just identified himself as a VP in the Kindle organization, which makes e-readers. But at the time, Amazon was actually working on the early stages of creating what later became the Echo. So this person stood to learn a lot from a meeting like that with Ubi, right? So Ubi and Amazon meet over the course of several meetings. It's looking like there might be some type of partnership, maybe even an acquisition of Ubi, which would be life-changing, and it would be a great platform for a small startup like his. And then Amazon reaches out to the founders and says, hey, I know we signed an NDA. We're going to void that for all meetings going forward. You know, these were kind of green entrepreneurs. They didn't understand what that meant, that, you know, anything that was discussed would no longer be proprietary, basically if you void an NDA, a non-disclosure. And they thought maybe that was a signal that Amazon was going to buy them or make an offer. So they just said, okay, fine. And then what happens is something that plays out a lot when you speak to entrepreneurs who've met with Amazon. They've now handed over their roadmaps, their engineering information. They've spoken about their proprietary technology. They've done the demo. Now Amazon stops returning Lior's phone calls. Emails don't get answered. And it's kind of weird. They feel like they've been left at the altar. Cut to late 2014, and Lear gets an email from his brother. And the subject line is, uh-oh. And he opens it up, and it contains a link to an article about Amazon's new Echo device, which obviously does a lot of the same things that this Ubi device did. And he was just gutted. He thought this would be something he went to market with. He actually had sold 3,000 of them through his Kickstarter, but he really just had to pivot after that because Echo became winner takes all.
You open the Everything War discussing a paper by Lena Khan, who is the current chair of the Federal Trade Commission. And it's a paper she wrote back when she was in law school at Yale. Why did you begin the book there?
We began the book with Lena Khan's paper about Amazon being a monopoly because that story really comes full circle. And it's kind of amazing if you look at the rise of Lena Khan. In 2014, she was a student that just graduated from college. She joins this think tank in D.C. called Open Markets, and she starts researching monopoly power, not an area she has like any sort of expertise around, right? She goes there and she starts seeing Amazon come up a lot. She learns a lot about the giant, and she starts making the connections between Amazon and Standard Oil, which is this Gilded Age monopoly that was broken up by the Supreme Court in 1911. And she just thinks there's just a lot of parallels there, and it's dawns on her that it's strange that at this time, everyone views Amazon as this darling, yet Standard Oil was broken up for some of the same practices, right? So she goes to Yale Law School, and over the course of a few years, she puts together this really radical law review article that publishes in 2017. And that article, which kind of miraculously from a student, 27 years old at the time, starts to change the way that people think about Amazon. Mm. People start using the words Amazon and monopoly in the same sentence. They start questioning if it's fair that the company that owns the world's biggest online marketplace also competes on it. What does Amazon do with all of that data that it collects, right? So people start to become skeptical. She just has this meteoric rise. And it, like I said, it comes full circle. She then later works on Congress's investigation into big tech, including Amazon. And then in 2021, she is picked to be the youngest chairperson in the Federal Trade Commission's 100-year history. And it's almost as if President Biden handpicked the person Amazon would be most fearful of regulating them to be at the head of this agency.
What was the general thesis of the paper? What was she highlighting about Amazon at the time?
The thesis of the paper was that Amazon had almost risen to be a modern-day utility. Mm. It was a service that people needed to use, that competitors needed to be on, and that it just had this unassailable perch in modern corporations. She highlighted a practice of Amazon using predatory pricing to undercut competition and bring them to their knees. She spoke about how Amazon was able to grow by offsetting losses in retail by other parts of its empire in ways that other companies could not do. Not everyone has a cloud computing company to provide margins to offset your prices in retail. So she really takes this critical look at the giant and frames it as an unintended consequence of a change in antitrust interpretations from the 1970s and 80s that sort of allowed what is basically a digital Gilded Age monopoly to appear.
Own It All, the tactic driving the Amazonopoly, next.
Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. Your body is your own. That's why Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Today, lawmakers who oppose abortion are challenging Planned Parenthood. Affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. Planned Parenthood believes that health care is a basic human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies. They also work tirelessly to oppose the onslaught of new policies aimed at interfering with personal decisions best left to patients and their doctors. They won't give up, and they won't back down. you can join Planned Parenthood in the fight to help make sure that the next generation can decide their own futures. The organization needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
Support for this show comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise, an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab, tracks the stories making news right now and breaks them down for the average investor. Host Mike Townsend, Charles Schwab's Managing Director for Legislative and Regulatory Affairs, takes a nonpartisan look at the stories that matter most to investors. He explores topics like policy initiatives for retirement savings, taxes, and trade, inflation fears, the Federal Reserve, and how regulatory developments can affect companies, sectors, and even the entire market. In every episode, Mike and his guests offer their perspectives on how policy changes could affect what you do with your portfolio. Download the latest episode and follow at schwab.com/WashingtonWise or wherever you listen.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
How has Amazon dodged repercussions for all of these actions through the years?
The reason that Amazon but also other big tech giants like Google and Facebook were able to grow unfettered is that there was a change in the way that antitrust was interpreted in the 1970s and 80s. And instead of trying to protect competition and rivals and small businesses, the focus shifted to protecting consumers, and something called the Consumer Welfare Standard was adopted. And generally, that boiled down to low prices. So that really favored the tech giants we see today because they either at the time had free products. If you think about Facebook or Google, you don't pay to use them as a consumer. Or, you know, back when Amazon was being written about by Lena Khan, low prices because they were undercutting the market. Mm. So they were able to kind of skate by under the banner of consumer welfare, low prices. But I think reframing antitrust in that way, the argument from Lena's camp would be that you allowed lots of other bad behaviors to slide by.
These practices we're talking about aren't a 21st century Silicon Valley innovation. This is a very old playbook. Tell us about the robber barons of yore.
So if you want to get into antitrust law, you sort of have to go back to the Gilded Age. And that's when the laws were first derived because there were these massive companies consolidating power in industries such as oil refining, sugar, and railroads. And these were called the trusts. Some of the most famous trusts include Standard Oil, you know, founded by John Rockefeller. And they accumulated so much power and crushed competition that the American public became wary of them. And, you know, these robber barons really started to symbolize corporate greed in America. And, you know, the federal government had to respond to that. So in 1890, they passed the first federal antitrust law called the Sherman Antitrust Act in order to outlaw monopolistic business practices.
Can you talk a little bit more about what the Sherman Act did? Take us back, you know, to 12th grade government and what that did.
So the Sherman Act was the first antitrust law. It was passed by Congress in 1890, and it aimed at preserving free and unfettered competition as the rule of trade. So it was sort of very broadly written, and that's part of the problem with antitrust laws is they could be interpreted in different ways.
Yeah. Where does the state of antitrust law stand right now?
Antitrust law, interestingly, has become like a really sexy area of policy after being like the redheaded stepchild for years and years.
I know.
And years.
I keep seeing all these things. I'm like, ooh, antitrust is back, baby.
It totally is, though. What's funny is, you know, the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed you know, and then Standard Oil was broken up because they violated the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1911. And then a few years later, the FTC was formed to regulate competition. And for decades and decades and decades, there was this trust buster movement where the laws were enforced to protect competition and small businesses and making sure everyone had a chance to compete. But over time, critics emerged that they thought that these laws, the way that they were being enforced, were actually causing more harm than good, and that they inhibited competition. And in the 1960s, there were a number of Supreme Court rulings in the antitrust realm that people thought went too far. And people thought that the Supreme Court was ruling in favor of David in Battles versus Goliath rather than actually protecting competition. Around this time, there was this movement out of the University of Chicago called the Chicago School, and they started rethinking the purpose of antitrust law, and they felt like the courts were too focused on the survival of small businesses. And, you know, they started coming up with this framework that we use today called this consumer welfare standard, which really changed everything about antitrust and how it was enforced. And the result there is that once that framework was adopted and that was brought to mainstream by a book called The Antitrust Paradox by Robert Bork, who was part of the Chicago School, once that went mainstream, it meant that big wasn't necessarily bad. Actually, big could provide economies of scale and maybe lower prices. And competition was judged less on their effects on competitors, but their effects on efficiency and prices for customers. And that tended to favor scale. And that had really big repercussions.
I'm curious how technology has kind of played a role in where we are with antitrust right now. I mean, tech just moves so quickly. And if you look at, you know, Congress, if you look at regulators, even if you look at our day-to-day lives, we move so much more slowly than the technology. It can be a lot to keep up with. And I just, yeah, I wonder how that impacts antitrust law.
Well, part of the problem that Lena Khan pointed out in her paper and also in, you know, public speaking is that the laws that were reinterpreted in the 1980s have allowed companies to become monopolies because they were judging on a very narrow set of rules about price. In the subsequent years, once that new rule was adopted, you know, there was less government regulation. Fewer mergers were blocked. We went from 15 monopoly cases a year between 1970 and 1999 to 3 a year between 2000 and 2014. So these companies were able to grow. And companies like Amazon, but also Tech Brethren, really, really benefited from that. And they also have the added, I would say, benefit of being kind of Byzantine, harder to understand when you have lots of politicians that are on the older side that maybe aren't using some of these products as often, or, you know, you think about things like TikTok, it could be a little bit harder to regulate.
I'm curious what kind of some of those workarounds we've seen businesses like Amazon use to kind of get around the current antitrust system.
So for better part of Amazon's history, it didn't really have to get around the antitrust system because it favored them. The way the laws were being interpreted favored them. And anytime Amazon was criticized for different behaviors, they would rely on the consumer welfare standard. I've spoken to S team members at Amazon that had reported to Jeff Bezos, and I brought this up with them, and it's in the book where they say, you know, as long as we're delivering for consumers, we are not liable for, you know, antitrust violations. And they just kept their head down and focused on the consumers.
Real quick, just want to note, when Dana refers to the S team, that's the most senior leadership at Amazon.
What's interesting now with Lena Khan at the head of the FTC, this agency, and John Cantor at the head of the DOJ, who has a very similar frame of mind around this, is that they think that we need to go back to pre-Borkian antitrust interpretations. We need to go back to how it was done in the beginning. And that could spell trouble for the likes of Amazon, because it won't just be about consumer prices. And, you know, when you speak to people that are in the neo-Brandeisian frame of mind, where Lena identifies herself, they say, you know, just because some of these laws haven't been enforced in 40 years, it doesn't make the behavior any less illegal. And now they're coming after those behaviors.
Up next, what would it take to break up Amazon?
Michael Cohen, Trump's former attorney, fixer, and friend, testified this week in Manhattan.
Todd Blanche is upset because he knows that he looks like a fool right now representing Donald Trump. It is the stupidest opening to a cross-examination I have ever heard, and I have heard a lot of stupid stuff.
I'm Preet Bharara, and this week, Katie Fang, host of MSNBC's The Katie Fang Show, joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet, to talk about the latest court news from Trump's trial. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway.
And I'm Ed Elson.
And we're the hosts, the co-hosts. It's kind of unfair to call us co-hosts. I'm really the host. He's my Robin Givens. Let's just be clear on what this is. But anyways, we're the hosts of Prop G Markets, your go-to podcast for all things money. Every Monday, we provide brash, unfiltered analysis on market-moving news, high-flying stocks, growing sectors, stupid boardroom decisions, and master of the universe CEOs.
And on Thursdays, we speak with some of the world's greatest finance professors, Wall Street insiders, and industry experts to keep you informed without getting bored. So if you want to understand money and how you can get more of it, you have to talk about money, and we're here to help you do that. Follow Prof G Markets on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts to automatically receive new episodes every Monday and every Thursday.
That's right. The good news is we know how to get you economic security. The bad news is the answer is slowly. We'll tell you how on Prop G Markets.
This week on The Pitch, we're back to pitches. And this one's coming from my job.
What Podcast AI does is it lets podcast producers become 10 times more productive.
How much are you charging The Pitch?
We're charging $99. And Josh came in right before we doubled our prices.
What's keeping something like a Restream from just going like, yep, we do all this AI now stuff too?
So there's a lot of these older companies that are tacking on AI. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the issue. They're tacking it on.
You built this really quickly. What's to stop anybody else from doing this? What's the moat?
How do you build a moat when you're building with AI? That's this week on The Pitch. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, Dana, in 2023, the FTC announced that it was suing Amazon. What is the FTC's argument and what's the status of that right now?
The FTC is alleging two things. So first of all, Amazon knows that sellers need to be on Amazon.com. 40% of all online shopping in the U.S. happens on Amazon.com. So that gives it tremendous leverage with its sellers. And also, Amazon has 200 million people that have signed up for Prime accounts. So if you're selling something, you need to be there, right? With that in mind, they're able to levy all sorts of fees on its sellers. And in some ways, Amazon's become a bit pay-to-play. Mm. So in order to be on Prime, you need to be part of Amazon's fulfillment program. And in order to show up in search, you need to buy advertisements. And Amazon collects a fee each set of the way. And they also collect other fees on top of that. And it's gotten to the point where for every dollar a third-party seller makes in revenue on Amazon, Amazon takes 50 cents. So keep that in mind, because with that surge in fees, many of these sellers have had to raise their prices of their goods to offset all the fees and be viable. But what's really, really interesting about the FTC lawsuit is that they say that Amazon doesn't just raise prices on Amazon.com, but throughout the entire online economy. And that's because up until recently, if you were a third-party seller on Amazon selling, let's say, a bicycle, and you had to sell the bicycle for a certain dollar amount to offset all of Amazon's fees, you couldn't sell that bike at a lower price on a different platform because you'd be in violation of their policy. And that violating that policy could come with like pretty draconian measures. It could mean being buried in search. It could mean being kicked off of their website. And sellers really live in fear of that. They really don't want to poke the bear and get kicked off the website because that could ruin their business. So if Amazon's fees have gotten so high that you had to raise your prices on Amazon.com in order to have any margin, you're doing that elsewhere. So basically, the FTC says Amazon has such asymmetric power in online retail and such a monopoly over its sellers that pricing does not exist in a vacuum at Amazon. It affects the overall online economy.
Is there a public appetite to break up Amazon. I mean, it seems like Amazon is a thing that people love to hate, but that's right up until you need to restock on toilet paper and then you're, you know, getting that Prime delivery.
I think, you know, people really do love their Amazon Prime, right? It definitely saved a lot of people during COVID. So I think the idea of just a wholesale breakup of the company could be concerning to some people. I actually think, you know, what the FTC is pursuing, yeah, they're saying that this behavior is illegal, that it's a monopoly, that it could result in a breakup of Amazon. But my guess is it would be a very targeted breakup of Amazon.
Amazon isn't the only tech company that's getting attention from the likes of the Department of Justice or the FTC. You know, we've seen cases recently against Google and Meta and now Apple. Why are we seeing this trend emerge? What does this tell us about, you know, the current business outlook?
There's been a broader tech clash in America and actually all across the world. These companies were once the darlings of Washington, D.C. They were these bastions of innovation, right? And they were places of job creation that the country really rallied around. But I think over the last few years, following the 2016 election in particular, the public has started to question the power of big tech. Mm. Things like misinformation, mental health disorders from addiction to social media, right? And then also the power of companies like Amazon on the other side of this that maybe aren't involved in social media but are affecting competition in different ways. So there's been a much closer look at big tech from a policy standpoint and bipartisan investigations into big tech, which is something we're not seeing much of these days. But people have aligned around the thought that big tech has gotten too big.
So there's a Google case and Meta won their case. Does that tell us anything about what could happen for Amazon? Is it kind of a non-starter?
The FTC and Lina Khan, you know, if they want to have a different reinterpretation of antitrust, it does take some time to filter into the courts and change minds and opinions. And the FTC lost with its Facebook challenge of an acquisition called Within Unlimited. They also lost on Microsoft's acquisition of Activision. What I would say with this Amazon lawsuit, which is kind of a bit of a white whale, just given where Lina Khan came from, is it's much more narrowly focused. It seems a lot more careful to me. And it is kind of the traditional consumer welfare standard. Even though she's railed against the consumer welfare standard, at the end of the day, this lawsuit comes down to higher prices for consumers.
So we're also in an election year, and it's another matchup between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. Khan was appointed by Biden. How could a Trump win in November impact things or shift things?
For Amazon or for her?
Yeah, for Amazon.
I think it's really interesting. So the book gets into some pretty meaty details about battles between Amazon and the Trump presidency, which was obviously very critical of Jeff Bezos and Amazon. And also, you know, they were hoping that it would be a Biden presidency. They were really well positioned for that. They hired Jay Carney, who was a senior aide for President Obama, who had worked with Joe Biden at the White House to head up government relations and public policy. And what's really fascinating to me is that there was so much rhetoric and nasty tweets and name calling from Donald Trump about Jeff Bezos during those 4 years that they thought Biden would be better. Mm. And it's actually been the opposite. While Trump was a lot of rhetoric, Biden has had significant policies that hurt Amazon. So he not only placed Lina Khan at the head of the FTC, that was his decision. He's also like the most, he calls himself the most pro-union president in American history, which is not great for Amazon, which is famously anti-union. And what I've learned over the course of reporting my book is that Jeff Bezos has been persona non grata at the Biden White House. There's actually been a lot of bad blood.
Yeah, it sounds like the 2024 election is a lose-lose for Jeff Bezos.
Completely agree.
Does it feel like the tide is turning here a bit? Do you think there's momentum building to strengthen antitrust laws or at least, you know, break some of these companies up a little bit?
I do think the tide is turning, and I think that's backed up by seeing some of these like really strange bedfellows aligning on this. You know, this antitrust specifically when it relates to Amazon and some of big tech having too much power, is something that people that literally agree on nothing else agree on. Mm-hmm. Senator Warren and Matt Gaetz, Joe Biden and people in the Trump administration agree on this, right? So there's bipartisan momentum. Yes, there's been some court losses, but there's also been some wins as of late. And it'll be really interesting to see if they're able to get, you know, a lot more done.
Yeah, if they don't get more done, you know, if laws aren't strengthened or, you know, there aren't consequences, what does the trajectory of Amazon look like? I mean, they're already in so much of our lives. I'm trying to imagine, like, where else they could reach in.
It's really fascinating to me is that, you know, Amazon has really gotten hit from every angle. They've had this historic FTC lawsuit levied against them that could break the company up. They've been criticized by politicians all over the world. But even in light of that, they almost lack a self-awareness about what this could mean. Mm. And I have an anecdote in the book that, you know, in the middle of the FTC trying to break this company up, Amazon's top leader, their CEO, Andy Jassy, told his deputies that Amazon could be a $10 trillion company one day, like the world's largest company. So they don't think $2 trillion is enough, right? So there's $8 trillion of growth left. So I just think they're really plodding along.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, you know, the goal is own it all. Like, I do wonder, like, okay, is there a point where you're like, okay, we did it. We're satisfied with this. But maybe, you know, that's just not in the nature of the company.
That's not the culture of this company. It's not the culture. The culture is you're only as good as your last hit. I even spoke to an S team member who said this, like, people there feel dispensable. And there is stack ranking so that every year among this world-class pool of talent from MIT and Stanford and Harvard and really the smartest people, no matter what, 6% of them are getting cut. So everyone's got a fire burning under them to get stuff done and differentiate themselves from their other brilliant colleagues. And I do think that comes into play here. You know, just speaking to the ethos of Amazon, Jeff Bezos created this culture and it really was insatiable, even from the early days. There's an anecdote in the book. It's 2006. It's right after the holiday season. And all of the retail elite are going to this gala in New York. And it's Diane von Furstenberg and the CEOs of Saks Fifth Avenue and Macy's. And Jeff's there for the first time. And it's kind of, he doesn't really fit in, right? Amazon's not really like a big apparel seller at this point. It's known for books and widgets. And one of my sources sees him at the bar and says, you know, what are you doing here? And he turns around and says, your margin is my opportunity.
Ooh.
Right? So I think that sort of sentiment runs deep. That was 2006, but I do still think that exists today, that you see them forging into ever more industries, most recently healthcare, space with Project Kuiper. Everyone's margin is their opportunity.
Dana Mattioli, thank you so much for joining us on The Weeds.
So fun to join you.
Amazon will have its day in court in October 2026. Not exactly as fast as two-day delivery. Until then, we wait to see what happens. While you wait, you could read Dana's book, The Everything War. It's available now in stores. And you can find a non-Amazon link in our show notes. That's all for us today. Thank you to Dana Mattioli for joining me. Our producer is Sophie Lalonde. Krishna Ayala engineered this episode. Melissa Hirsch fact-checked it. Our editorial director is A.M. Hall. And I'm your host, Jonquilin Hill. This podcast is part of Vox, which doesn't have a paywall. Help us keep it that way by going to vox.com/give.
Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.